I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week we're chatting to Triona Campbell. Her new novel is YA, Young Adult. It's called The Traitor in the Game. We talk about writing for teens and getting the voice right. It's incredibly tough to pitch that well. Also, how she's written across different forms of mediums, radio and telly and now novels. What has she learned? What's the same? What's changed throughout those? And you can hear why an incredibly boring tone of voice really helps.
And at the end of the day, I will normally, there's this button on Microsoft Word where you can hit read aloud, and I will put it into the most boring tone of voice that I can find and read whatever I've written during the day, get it read back to me. So you can listen to the words and realize, you know, what words you've maybe used too often in the sentence and paragraph, and start to like fine tune it a bit more and see what the cadence of it is and how it would flow.
There is more with Triona Campbell in this week's Writer's Routine. Welcome along. This is Writer's Routine, where we take a look through an author's working day. We see how they get stuff done, where they work, how they work, how they plan their life, their job, their families, and their ideas to give them the best chance of getting things down on the page. This week we are sponsored by the new true crime podcast. It's called Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? And it's perfect for us, I think. Because if you love crime writing, I reckon you might. If you love storytelling, I absolutely think you do. And if you enjoy podcasts, which I really hope you do, this is right up your street. Who is the Cheese Wire Killer is about a 1983 murder, unsolved. It's now regarded as one of Scotland's most gruesome unsolved cases. And the killer is still on the run. Just a few months ago, the police announced the biggest step forward in the case for the past 40 years. And across five episodes, told through a mixture of documentary and drama, you are placed right in the middle. You can go into the very centre of a live investigation. There are quite a few true crime podcasts out there vying for space in your feed, but this does something that no other can. It's happening right now, and you can be part of it. With interviews from the senior investigating officer, forensic scientists, psychologists, as well as family members and friends of the victim. It's such a brilliant twist on true crime podcasts. It's a classic whodunit case that has baffled the police for over 40 years, and you can be right in the middle of it. Find the series now, listen to the whole lot wherever you get your shows, search for Who is the Cheese Wire Killer, and try and solve one of the most famous murders ever. This week we're chatting to Triona Campbell. Triona has done, written and created a bit of everything, really. She's a three-time Emmy-nominated producer of kids and teen media, creating many dramas for teens. She's written radio plays, and after a career change a few years ago, has just published her second novel. It's called The Traitor in the Game. It's the sequel to her YA debut, A Game of Life and Death. It's all about Asha, her and a team who enter an esports tournament in New York when it becomes increasingly harder to keep controlling the game. We talk about getting it right for teens, why it's so easy to get wrong, and what a YA novel needs to find an audience. Also, you can hear why it's all about the obstacles, throwing them in front of your characters, how hard the switch was from telly to novels and what she misses. You can hear more about the classic adage that writing is rewriting. I know we've run through that before, but it is always wise to keep banging the drum for editing. And you come for the book advice, you stay for the board game moans. There is a banging in this episode, by the way. I don't know what was going on, and maybe Triona, someone was having work done in an apartment nearby. So just bear that in mind. There's nothing going wrong with, well, your headphones or your ears, I guess. Anyway, we start a little bit different this week. Triona, for the last few months, has been in Portugal, uprooting her life, moving there for a year or so, just to try and write somewhere new.
I had this professor when I was in college and was learning screenwriting, and he always said the best thing about being a writer was you can write from anywhere. And when I got the book deal with Scholastic, I thought, oh, maybe I should test that out.
Brilliant. How often do you... Well, is this your first experiment with writing somewhere that's not properly your home, that's kind of have laptop, will travel?
I gotta say, probably not. I think when I worked with Sony, we worked everywhere. I mean, we shot in places like the favelas in Brazil, and, you know, we did stuff in Greece, in France, in the UK. So I kind of got used to that whole notion of if you have a laptop and a pair of headphones and decent coffee, you can pretty much go anywhere.
But that's kind of for work, right? Whereas, have you gone there specifically to write?
I've gone on writer's retreats before to write, and that's been nice. This is like, this is my first time kind of going to a place for just like to have, I don't know, you fall into a routine when you're at home, don't you? Like, it's kind of like you have your favorite place to get coffee. You have your morning routine, you do this, you do that. And you almost get a little bit, I don't know, it's probably just me. I get a little lazy. Because it's so easy and simple and you know exactly what you're doing. And I kind of like the challenge of throwing yourself into a place where you don't even speak the language and you have to learn the customs. And it's kind of nice.
Well, no, I mean, the show is writer's routine, Triona. So how long have you been in Porto? How long are you planning to be there? Is this an open-ended thing? What's the deal?
I've been here for like a couple of months now, and I think we're going to, like, I'm married, I have kids, I have enrolled them in school here, so we are definitely here for the next 18 months at least.
And how was the rest of the family when you decided this was happening?
They're good. Like, my kids are still there in secondary school. They don't have any major exams yet. I found a really brilliant international school that teaches through English over here. But for me and my husband as well, it was really important that our kids grow up speaking more than one language, that they would be bilingual. And over here, they're becoming trilingual because they're doing English, they are learning Portuguese, and they're also learning French as well at the moment. So for us, it's great. And I think learning languages is something that I always wish I had been better at. So I'm really glad that they're doing that.
I mean, through envy, I guess. I'm really interested in this. I don't want to. So what was the lead up time to making this decision? So you'd always been told by a tutor way back that, you know, if you're a writer, you can go anywhere. But because you're doing it for such a stint, you know, this isn't a 2 week break. You've enrolled your kids in school. What was the preparation like to get away?
Insane. The tutor in question was a guy called John Sherlock, and he was a teacher of screenwriting at Trinity when I was at Trinity, and he was fascinating. Like, he's like, you know, an English guy from the north of England who went over to Canada at some point as a like jobbing journalist, and through really strange set of circumstances, his first assignment was as a reporter on the campaign trail for JFK. So he covered that whole story up until the presidential election, and then he moved to Hollywood. And while he was there, he created a show called Peyton Place, which went on to become one of the longest running American soap operas of all time. And, you know, he was friends with Marilyn Monroe. Like, he had a really fascinating life. And at some point he decided, okay, I've made enough money, I want to go and do something else. And he went to Trinity for a year just to teach. I think he gave them like money as well, you know, to endow a scholarship in his name or something. And he did several master classes then on screenwriting and television drama. And at one point I was just chatting to him and he said, that's the best thing about being a writer is, you know, you could write from anywhere in the world nowadays. You don't have to be linked to the writer's room. You can just email your work over. And then during lockdown, like I watched so many friends who were part of writer's rooms, which traditionally would have meant they had to go to LA. And suddenly it was like, no, we're just going to do this on Zoom and we're going to do this in different time zones, but it's going to work. And I think, yeah, it kind of started me thinking. So it was a long lead-in process. It was like, you know, 18 months of, could we do this? How would the kids feel? What would they feel like? And my husband was really supportive because he is partly Portuguese. So he really wanted to come. And then we kind of said, okay, we'll do a trial run. We'll go over for 6 weeks and rent a place and just go there and not be on holiday, but just like really kind of be there in terms of, okay, where's the grocery store? What's the nearest place? Where's the park? Where is the libraries? Where is this? How do we get from A to B? And after that 6 weeks, we came back and we thought, yep, this is it. We really want to try this for a while. And it was a good time to do it too. Like our kids aren't doing really big state exams and it just seemingly, it just kind of worked.
And you mentioned, you know, the writing routine back home getting quite staid and predictable. You fall into your traps, don't you? How much has this invigorated you?
I think it's been huge in some, and I wasn't expecting it to be as huge as it has been, but it's like that. I think you can write from anywhere. You can definitely write from where you are at home. I wrote my first book from where I was at home, but there's that sense of when you're writing someplace else, you almost have this overview of the place you're writing about because you're not there. You've taken a step back from it and you can actually look at it in its totality as opposed to living in it on a day-to-day basis. And I really liked that. And I liked feeling challenged. And I also liked the culture, like getting to know a different culture. We have a tendency to be very rooted in English-speaking literature. And I really wanted to broaden my horizons on that too and start to like learn about other cultures. And particularly in Portugal, there's this whole thing with the Knights Templar. And, you know, there's a lot of similarities, but there's also a lot of different things. And I liked it. Like, I really like it, I have to say.
Well, so just tell us about where it is you sit down to write then. From back home in Ireland over to where you are now in Portugal. When you sit down, when you start writing of a day, what's around you? Take us through everything that you can see.
Okay. When I was writing in Dublin, I had a very small book room. Like it was kind of, I don't know, the size of a probably ensuite bathroom, but it was fully lined from floor to ceiling with books and a desk. And a really big window. And outside that window, there were trees, there was a road. You could quite nicely daydream if you needed to. And a really massive monitor because I find it easier to work on a big screen. And I would sit there. And my first book, I think I wrote between the hours of 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. every morning because I was working a job. I have kids. I was also looking after my dad, who was quite elderly at that stage. So it was a lot. And the only time that I could really have as mine was like between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. because at 7, the kids needed to get up for school. So that was my block. And every day I just sat there with a coffee and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and just kept going. And then lockdown happened. And during lockdown, I got awarded a mentorship from Words Ireland with the lovely Louise O'Neill, who's written amazing books like Asking for It and Idle and lots of other books. And she was like my lifeline in some ways because everyone's very remote, but we were having these chats about this book and these characters. And she was just like, you need to write faster. I really like this. You have something here. And so that's kind of like how I finished the book, I think. And then I sent it off to Marion Gunn O'Connor, who's my agent, and she sent it out on submissions. And I ceased to think of it because I thought, you know, it is really hard getting published these days. It's hugely It's a huge feat to actually get something out there, because it seems like particularly there's a lot of celebrity authors out there. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of people who, like me, would have written books during lockdown who are now trying to pitch them and get them out there. So I kind of was, you know, managing my expectations of how this would work. But then she rang me and she said, oh, we have an offer. And I thought, that's so super, an offer, brilliant, we'll go with them. And she was like, oh no, we're not doing that. We have other offers. And she opened it up to auction, and it went three rounds with, I think, five, six publishers before it closed with Scholastic. So it was, and it was huge. It was just, I was completely unexpected, and I totally wasn't prepared for that. I was kind of prepared for it to not be successful. When it became like, oh, it's going to get picked up and published, I was kind of like, I wasn't prepared.
Well, there's so much there. So from you being completely unprepared, you simply writing it, as many people did, as you mentioned, because of lockdown, but now, well, that got published, you've got a deal, you've got another one published, you're in Portugal now writing many more proper novels. How have you had to readjust, I guess, your mindset? Because this is actually happening.
It has been interesting, I think. I come from television production, so I'm very used to talking about shows that I've produced, but I've been used to talking about them in terms of the director is really great, the cast are really brilliant. And I'm kind of quite okay with that behind the scenes thing. I love that. But this was front and center, and I wasn't prepared for that going out. And I have a real problem with people when they're complimentary. Like, I just kind of go, okay. And I, like, 9 times out of 10 think they probably said that to everybody. But my agent is like, no, they haven't said that to everybody. You should really take this on board. And I was like, oh, okay. So it's been a huge change as well, because the money meant that I could write full time and not have to juggle it with a television career. And that's made a huge difference. And it's also opened up other things in terms of writing that I hadn't thought about doing. Like, on the back of this, I wrote a radio drama for the first time, which I hadn't tried to do before. And that is now on its third season. Like, it's won, you know, awards in New York, and it's now becoming this thing in its own right, because they're looking at adapting it for screen. So it's been constantly like an incredible journey where I'm pinching myself a lot as we go through it, going, oh, this is my life now. This is insane.
I often speak to authors about the change of suddenly writing full time, but I always do it from the perspective of, well, this is great now. You've got a full day. You can write whenever you like. But also, I guess it's important to touch about what you're now not doing. You know, you're a TV producer. Clearly, you enjoy that work, right? To immerse yourself in that for so many years, and now to have the opportunity to not do that, to pursue something else. How has that been, switching modes and kind of taking off your TV production hat for a little while and putting that in the past for a bit?
It was an adjustment, I think, at first, because I still almost wasn't not producing. I was kind of like looking at things and going, that would make a great series. And then I had to switch off and kind of go, no, somebody else can do that series, not you. You need to like take a step back. And I was really used to, there's a buzz of TV runs on adrenaline a lot of the time. And you have like your crew is like your family. I tended to work with the same DOP, the same sound guy, the same production manager, you know, I know a lot of actors who became friends over the years. So it was very different to turning from that big kind of collaborative sense of creating something, which is just images on a screen, to going into a room and creating something in your head where you're trying to paint it in such a way that the reader is creating those images in their own head, as opposed to you showing them what it is. And I think books are fantastic for that, because it becomes really about the internal voice of the characters, the things that you could never portray on radio or on television or on the big screen without doing very clunky voiceover, which I think doesn't always work. But, you know, it really gets to you, allows you to go and immerse yourself deeper into the story world. But it was a big change being from a big collaborative production office to kind of like just being you at the desk.
And do you miss that? Do you miss that working with others to the extent that you were?
I think I do. And I think that's probably why I went back and I wrote the radio drama in some ways, because it allowed me to get a group of actors that I really like into a studio and just have them read and perform the words I'd written and actually just work with them on that. And I did that last summer, and that was a really nice break to go over to Dublin to sit in the studios over there and to record it for the national broadcaster over there. And that was lovely. But I've kind of developed my own routine. Like, I mean, you asked about where you write from now. And I found, for me, I rented an office space in a co-working space because I need to have that feeling of getting out of the house and going somewhere and writing somewhere and treating it almost like this is it. You're in front of this desk now from 9 until 1, and then you're having a break and you're maybe going for a walk and clearing your head. And then I write until 4. And at that stage, I'm kind of like cutting off and creatively probably drained and wondering what emails I need to answer. But for me, that is now the new kind of routine. And it's nice because it's a collaborative co-working space. So there are people doing other things that are not related to what I do, but it's still nice to have like a canteen where there's people and there's buzz and there's energy.
Well, we will do more on the routine, I promise you. The show is writer's routine. We cannot gloss over it just like that. Very quickly, so you're in your new shared co-working space, which, as you say, is brilliant because you've got buzz, you've got energy around you, but it also isn't the most creative setting, I would imagine, because, you know, you can't design it as you will. You can't have plot points around you. You can't have maybe inspirational photos. You can't have copies of your books near you. So when you are there, how have you managed to kind of make it as best to get you working? Is it just you and a laptop? Do you have notebooks? Just run us through that kind of setup.
Well, first of all, to get there, there's this walk through the park I do every morning, which is just like trees and nature and fresh air. And it's a co-working space in a place called Matheusinhos, which is beside Porto. So it's on the beach. And it's a really nice old warehouse that they have converted into an office space. So it's incredibly funky. Like, there's one wall, which is a glass fish tank. It is an insane space. And in that space, I have like a small cubby hole, but it's kind of like it's kind of closed off from the other cubby holes by what is essentially pinboard. So my space has pictures that I find inspirational. It has story structures. It has plot points. It has post-its. It has all of those things. And I have two huge kind of like monitors that I use there, and a small like Mac mini, which I use. And I've linked all of my stuff on the cloud. So if I'm working in the office, I have access to all my files from there. But also if I'm working from a laptop at home, or I'm traveling and working on a laptop, it's all the same files and they all update through the system to the cloud, and then I can access through either place. And I put on a pair of headphones, and I am one of those writers who likes to write with music. So I have like soundtracks for different projects based on what I think those characters would listen to, or the kind of vibe I'm going for with that story. And I literally put on a pair of headphones and I just disappear into it. And then come up at around lunchtime when I get hungry and go, oh my God, what happened? And then go for a walk on the beach after having lunch and come back to it after that. And it's really nice. It's very focused. I have recently decided to prioritize, like, I'm doing this thing where you pick a phrase every year and try and stick to it. And my phrase this year has been the year of health, because I don't know, I think we're all pretty bad at kind of putting ourselves last on that list. So I start 3 mornings a week. I will start by going to the pool and just swimming, and then going to the office at about 10:30. But most mornings I get up earlier than my kids. So I still have that that hour of just kind of working through things that I need to do during the day, or making lists, or finishing for a deadline, or just familiarizing myself with the story, or kind of getting stuff down on paper that I need to. I do meditate in the mornings as well for like 10 minutes just to kind of like clear my head for the day. And then it's very much about the kids after that. I have two kids. They need to get to school. Their school starts at like, they leave the house at about 7:45. They're in school for 8 a.m. and they start classes at 8:10. So it's about getting them at the door and finding where somebody left shoes, and did you charge your laptop, and do you have your lanyard for getting into the school? Because their school has a security system whereby you need to present that before you can actually get into the building. And do you have your snacks, and what are you doing afterwards, and do you have tennis today, and did you bring your racket? And it's all of that craziness. And then after that, I tend to go to the office. I'm in the office by sometimes 8:30. And I make a very large cup of coffee then and kind of sit down and have a look to see if there's anything really, really urgent on emails. But I try not to, because I tend to be one of those people who gets distracted. And I really try to make the first thing that I do in the morning actually be about the writing and showing up for the writing and just putting thoughts down on paper. And then I am a big fan of structure. I guess that might be from working in film and TV, because film and TV is very structural orientated. You know, it's the three act structure or the eight sequences, depending on whether you're reading Sid Field or someone else. And in television, it was very much about writing to the ad break and having a cliffhanger before the ad break, so as people will come back after the ad break, you know, after they made their cup of tea and sit down and watch the rest of the episode. So I took all of that. I think when I started looking at books, I really do plan and plot out and kind of look at where the cliffhangers and hooks might be for the reader and how the reader's experience of this book is going to be before I start into it. And then I just write. I write from beginning to end. I have gotten better about writing at first drafts and realizing that the only person who sees them is me. So it's okay for it to be rushed and kind of just about getting the story down on paper. And then I will go back and methodically kind of go through stuff. And at the end of the day, I will normally, there's this button on Microsoft Word where you can hit read aloud, and I will put it into the most boring tone of voice that I can find and read whatever I've written during the day, get it read back to me. So you can listen to the words and realize, you know, what words you've maybe used too often in the sentence and paragraph, and start to like fine tune it a bit more and see what the cadence of it is and how it would flow. And I find that really productive, actually, reading, getting stuff read aloud, because I'm so word blind by that stage that I'm filling in the bits that aren't there because that's what I think I'm trying to say. And it's only when something that is really analytical, like a computer voice, tells you that you haven't actually written that, and you kind of go, oh, okay, I need to go back there.
That's a really good trick. When you get home and it's been a busy day of writing, how good are you at switching off? Or for someone that is fully immersed in what they do throughout the day, do you find it's always there?
What I've tended to do is I try to get home before my kids and have like half an hour of just decompressing. If it's not raining, I'll walk home, because that way I'm listening to a podcast, and by the time I've arrived back at the house, I am completely like chilled out from what the day ahead was. I think as a writer, you never really, really turn off. Like I keep a notebook in my bag at all times, and I will be that person who's out doing something incredibly mundane and kind of go, oh, that's a really good idea. And I'll put the note into my phone and bring it and just email it to myself for later. But with children, you don't have an option. They don't care whether you're writing or not. They just want you to be there. So I play a lot of video retro games with them, with my kids, and board games, which end in huge family arguments. But like, it's fine, about cheating and exploding kittens and all of those things. And things like Catan and Seven Wonders and Ticket to Ride. So we play a lot of games, and I watch a lot of, well, I don't watch a lot, but I would like at least sit down after the kids have gone to bed with my husband and watch at least an hour of something. And I find that like kind of, I am pretty relaxed by that stage.
Have you ever won Settlers of Catan? I have played, I would say, over the course of the last decade with my best friend, who is incredibly smart and a good tactical thinker, and I've never ever won.
I have won at Catan, but bear in mind that my kids are like, you know, 11 and 14. So I have like kind of an age that I would hope that I would win. I'm winning less, actually. My son has taken up chess with a passion, and he actually joined the Portuguese Chess Federation and now does chess competition. So I am starting to lose on a regular basis.
Yeah, I can see how that might happen. So what constitutes a good day for you, Triona? I mean, if you're writing for, say, seven and a half hours, what do you like to get done? What are you happy with closing your laptop at the end of the day having done?
I think the best things that I write are probably in the morning. And if I can get 2,000 words in the morning, I am just golden. But like it tends to be about 1,200, 1,500. And I've discovered even with books, most of writing is actually rewriting. There's a lot of kind of going back and, you know, going through the structures and seeing where the mistakes are and getting notes and getting more notes and getting notes on top of that and going back again. So I do a lot of that in the afternoon, and I really try and keep the mornings for things that are new. And yeah, but there's that buzz, isn't there? You get that when you write something that, you know, is a new character, it's a new outline, it's a new story. I keep a notebook of other stories that I kind of want to delve into every now and again. And yeah, it is brilliant. Like, I mean, there's no way around it. This is the best lifestyle I could have invented for myself. It's great.
So this kind of big change that's happened recently in that you've gone to Porto to work, and although everyone is on board and your husband's very keen for it, how much pressure do you feel that you need to make this time worthwhile? Because you have instigated like quite a big upheaval in your family's life. One of the reasons is to give you a chance to write somewhere new. How much do you feel a responsibility to make this time worthwhile?
I think everybody feels that responsibility when they sit down in front of the laptop. Like, none of us have those lifestyles where you can go and just like write two sentences and then go off and walk or brood meaningfully around the house and then come back to it. Like, all of us are juggling things, you know, whether it be family or looking after elderly parents or having a job on top of trying to ride or whatever it is, you're always going to be juggling. There will always be something. And I try to make every second that I'm in front of a laptop count, because I'm normally working on three deadlines. Like, it's a running joke in my family. My daughter was saying, your WhatsApp line still says, I'm on a deadline, Mom. And it's been saying that for 12 months. And I was like, yeah, but I actually have been on a deadline for 12 months, because once you hand in a draft of the book, there was a draft of the radio plays. Once that came back, there was another draft of the book. Then there was a screenplay. And it seems to be nonstop. So, yeah, I don't have a lot of time to just stare at the screen and or wander meaningfully, but I really enjoy, like, on Friday afternoons, what I try to do is finish up by about two or three and go somewhere with a notebook or a book and just sit by the river or by the ocean and kind of doodle things and have that kind of blue sky thinking moment then. But the rest of the week is pretty much, you know, trying to get that 1,000 to 2,000 words per day on top of all the other stuff you're expected to do as a writer, which is like, you know, the emails and the yes, I can do that and the I will do a presentation for that thing and all of those other things, which I pretty much shove into the afternoon because I know that my brain will not be as sharp then.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One of Scotland's most notorious unsolved murders.
I was the first scientist to open up these items that had been stored by the police since the time of the crime.
And it's always been in my mind for over 40 years that I could have found the guy responsible.
I firmly believe that somebody out there knows something.
Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? Listen to the full series now, wherever you get your podcasts.
And Who is the Cheese Wire Killer is sponsoring the show this week. Make sure you take a listen wherever you get your podcasts. All 5 episodes are there for you to listen to. And you can support the podcast next week on the show. If you have published a book which hasn't quite got the fanfare that I am absolutely certain it deserves, let me do it for you. Your book can sponsor this show. And you can support us in so many other ways over on patreon.com/writersroutine. For just a few dollars a month, it helps us carry on. It helps me keep bringing you these chats with the best authors around as often as possible. You get merch. There is bonus content on there. There is even a way, as I say, for your book to sponsor this show. Let me talk about it. Let me plug it for the thousands and thousands of people who are with us every single week. To make that happen, I'd love to see you there supporting us. It's just me that does everything to keep it going. Get to patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it with Triona Campbell then, chatting through her new YA novel, The Traitor in the Game. It's all about Asha Kennedy in New York, who discovers a dark secret in the heart of a virtual reality game called Shackle. In this part, we chat about whether you can ever think about your readers too much. Sounds strange to even say those, doesn't it? Also, how she tries to get the teenage voice right. And we pick things up talking about what TV and creating and producing telly taught her about writing novels.
Maybe it's different from other people. Like I talk to other writers and they tell me that they just start writing and they kind of wing it. And I can't do that because I have like family and other things I need to consider. And for me to go and after 30,000 words go, this isn't working, I should drop it. I can't do it. I need to have plotted out before the beginning, middle and end and have a roadmap. I'm not saying it doesn't change when you're writing or something occurs to you or you get inspired by something else and it starts to shift and be something different. But I will always start with a roadmap. And my publisher will always demand a roadmap. It's like this thing of going back and forth with the synopsis or the outline for a new book. And that's, I'm currently doing that at the moment, actually, with book 3. And, you know, there are notes on terms of like, are you going to explore this? And is that going to be here? And I don't know about this as a twist. And it is planned. It might change a lot during the process, but it is very much planned. And television is like that. Television is it's the elevator pitch. It's the 3 sentences which you try to go and wrap up a story in. It's knowing what the themes of a show are and being able to pitch those to a commissioning editor so they know exactly what they're getting. It's about being able to visualize the characters enough so you can give a brief to a casting director and she knows or he knows what they're looking to bring in through the door to show the director. It's about having being able to describe to art department what the set is going to look like, and to the DOP what we're thinking of in terms of a look, whether it's saturated colors or it's dark lights, or, you know, in film for the big screen, it's a lot of play on shadows, whereas that's not going to work on television on a small screen because it is a smaller screen and nobody wants to see a small black screen. They want to have color visuals, a lot more close-ups in television than you would get in cinematography. So you learn to communicate, and I think those skills mean that when you go into writing a scene in a book, you really know how to describe it. And you probably put more on the page and then pull it back. Like, I will write character descriptions for my characters. I will know when their birthdays are, what their favorite song is, what foods they hate, something like things about their past, their childhood, when they met the other characters in the story. Not all of that is going to end up in the draft of the book, but I feel almost like that's a character brief I would have done in television. I need to do it for the books as well so that I know who these people are. And structure is a big thing. Like it's kind of like you going back to Dickensian times, you know, Dickens writing his books in terms of them being penny papers. And if, you know, the penny papers weren't selling, he didn't write the rest of the story. So it is kind of like about really thinking about your audience. Television really teaches you to think about audiences, because if you don't have an audience, the show is dead. It's not going to get recommissioned. It's not going to find a home. You really need to be thinking about the audience all the time. And I find with writing, I'm constantly thinking about the reader. And you touched there on social media. And I find that's becoming really interesting, because when I first started that, no one had read the first book I wrote. And it was kind of, it was okay. But now they have. And I have these like people who DM me or message me or whatever, and they're kind of like very invested in the characters, and you are not doing anything to this character, are you? He is coming back. She is going to end up with him. This is not going to go in some other way in book two. And I'm thinking to myself, oh God, are these people going to like me after they read book two? Because of course I have played with all of those ideas in terms of like reader expectations and how that story plays out and twists that are in there. So yeah, it's kind of nice actually having that feedback in some ways from readers who like the story and are as equally as invested in the characters as you.
But there must be the flip side of that coin, in that because readers' opinions are now much more vocal and accessible to you, and also, you're right, television gets you thinking about an audience, but perhaps to a degree that you think about it too much, and you're not just writing the story that you want to tell because you're constantly thinking about whether audiences will like it. And I mean, that is the way to, you know, commercial fiction, right? Books that sell. Do you ever contemplate the negative side of thinking about an audience too much?
I think we do. I mean, I would not go to Goodreads and read comments on my book, for example, because I know that even though somebody has had an, like, you know, sometimes people have an off day and they kind of take it out online and they put those words down there. Maybe they meet them, maybe they don't. Maybe the book isn't for them, and that's okay too. People have different tastes. But I don't read those comments because I find that I will just obsess about them. And I think that's probably quite a negative thing to do. So there are places where I will not go seeking for input, but there are other places like Instagram and stuff where the people who are there generally seem to be there because they like the book, and that's great. In terms of thinking about the readership, I think there is a tendency, isn't there, in commercial fiction to look at what's popular and jump on the bandwagon. I think that's something you shouldn't do, because by the time it's kind of come out and made it into the bookseller as a trend, the trend is almost always over. Because, you know, if I know there's a big trend at the moment in terms of romantasy, fantasy, But I think that's probably going to change, you know, within the course of a year. And so therefore, it has to really be the story that only you can tell, that you really want to tell, if you're going to put that much time into it. I wouldn't pay attention to the trends. I would definitely always think about the reader, because at the end of the day, I want to write books that people read and enjoy reading. So for me, whether or not they have, where do they get their information? Is there enough information there for them to start thinking about who did this thing? Is this enough of a cliffhanger to make them want to stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning reading this book? You know, those are the things I worry about. I worry less about the trends and what's popular or what's number one in the charts, because I think those kind of things tend to come in waves. And by the time you leap onto a wave, it's already gone. I really wanted to write from teens from the start. I think teens are amazing because they'll tell you instantly whether they like something or not. And they're very vocal. And I find that I think we should be doing more for both teens and children's publishing. I think it's something that is, and you really see it actually in Portugal when you walk into bookshops over here, because every bookshop that I walked into in Portugal has, it has Enid Blyton, it has Harry Potter, and it has David Walliams translated into Portuguese front and center. But they don't seem to have that many local children's writers. And it is, and if I think that's becoming universal when you look at bookshops, it's all Colleen Hoover, it's various different really big authors that have become really big brand names. And as a result, maybe we're not spending as much focus on smaller writers and new writers. And for me, in terms of children's literature, I think children in general, like in YA in general, is not getting the funding that adult content does. I think it's probably a really bad idea because kids deserve to see themselves reflected back in stories. And I love that market. And I love the urgency and immediacy of like writing in first person that you get with YA. But I've said all of that. But then, of course, I'm also aware that the readership for YA isn't always teens. It's like 48% are people who are over the age of 25. So, and I can vouch that that is quite true, because I do get messages from people who start the message with, I'm in my 40s, I'm in my 50s, I've never read YA before, but I really like this. And when's the next one coming? And it tends to be predominantly older women who really, really like it.
Well, I fully agree with you. I present for a children's radio station in the UK and make podcasts for them. So I completely agree of the kind of homogeny of the whole thing at the moment. And I also understand how easy it is to get wrong, how easy it is to pitch to what you think might be a 14-year-old, but you're actually pitching to a 9-year-old, right? It's an incredibly tricky tone to get right, especially YA, because quite a lot of it is in between, right? You have to grapple with big concepts, big ideas, but make them slightly more accessible than you would do, perhaps for a slightly older reader. How much thought did you give to finding that voice, and what did you do to make sure you were getting it right?
I am one of those people who, if I am on public transport, I am definitely eavesdropping on whatever teenage conversation is going on around me. I love actually, you know, tracking. I have books on like different expressions that teens come out with, you know, which I probably don't use in books because they date almost instantly, because they are so, that generation is so savvy and the turnaround is so fast. But I love listening to teens and random conversations of public transport. I also, from being in television, I've watched a lot of, and I've produced a lot of teen drama too, and seen how those work in terms of episodic drama series and how teens react to them. I find it amazing, actually, the things like The Gilmore Girls and even One Tree Hill are still relevant and being watched by teenagers now today. And I think, I don't know if that speaks to, we aren't making enough content for that age group, that they're going back to these things which would have been classic in the early 2000s, but, or whether it's the storytelling is still relevant to them today, whether that's why it is. But these things seem to be really popular on streamers like reruns of even the OC, Vampire Diaries, all of those things. They really have a long tail life. It's that. It's watching things that teens watch. It is reading a lot of YA books from authors that I love, like Cynthia Murphy, for example. I love her thrillers. And there's quite a good selection, actually, of Northern Irish writers who have come up recently with books titles like Grapefruit Moon, The Little Bang. All of those books are just very much reflecting, you know, the teen experience in one way or another. So I think if you immerse yourself in that, that is what you're going to write. And then at some point down the road, you really want to have a technical read. And it needs to be someone you trust enough to give the manuscript to, but who doesn't know you. Because if they didn't know you, they'll be nice and they'll say nice things about it. But if you can go to a friend who has a teenage kid, who's friends with other teenage kids, and find one of them and ask them to read something or read a couple of chapters or whatever, and then get their feedback, that tends to be more honest. And I like that too. I do technical reads for things like that with both teenagers and also with different, the first novel, I think it was a programmer and a video games designer. I got both of them to read the book after I'd finished, just because I wanted to make sure that the language, while not being so specific as to put it off people, was still going to be correct for that particular world.
So many of the TV shows that you speak about, and even heading a little earlier into teen drama and comedy, they kind of get tagged with, you know, the after school special thing of not just that you have to deal with a controversial subject and you have to teach about the way to live and what you should be doing as an adult life. How much do you find that needs to be the case through YA novels, that there is a good story there, but there's also an undercurrent of, you know, life lessons, quote unquote?
It's a fascinating subject, that, isn't it? The whole after school special notion of teenage drama. In fact, recently, my daughter was watching an episode of One Tree Hill, and they had this really random arc of like two episodes in where one of the characters meets somebody else who's in the US Army. I can almost guarantee you that was paid for by the US Army, because it's just so out there, so completely like looks like product placement. And it's like, yes, the US Army is great, we should all enlist. And you're just thinking, oh God, why did they do that? And it's something I think in TV that you get approached with a lot. I know when I was producing in London, our show was predominantly like paid for by a product placement with Sony. So we integrated things, we got cool integrations. Like we had the lead character was working in a magazine, and as part of the magazine, the script came to visit and talk about their new album. And that was a product integration with Sony Music. But for us, it was like, hey, it's Danny and the guys from the script, and we have them for a whole episode, and we can have some drama in here. And those kind of integrations were great. But I also remember the ones we turned down, like, you know, the Conservative Party approached us and said, could she be a Conservative voter? And I was like, no, she can't, because she's not going to vote either way. Like she isn't going to be that kind of person. You know, I don't think that's kind of what we should be telling kids in terms of trying to influence them politically. It's one thing to reflect like Rimmel makeup and have her wear that, or have some of the clothes come from H&M. It's another thing entirely for her to suddenly to become a political campaigner for her local Conservative MP. That's not going to happen. But we did do integrations which were very kind of like teaching about knife crime and the dangers of knife crime. And one of the main characters was killed off by a stabbing. And that was an integration that was paid for by the people who were trying to raise awareness for knife crime in London at the time. So yeah, there is always an after school special tendency. I think with YA books, there's less of that pressure because you're not selling advertising space within the book. I know there's a guy I met in Dublin, Russell Carroll Kelly, who has a character that he writes who's a rugby player. And he told me he was approached by Hennessy wondering if his character would drink Hennessy in one of the books. And they were willing to pay him like $50,000 just to have that. And he was like, no.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
It is. But like, his books were phenomenally popular in Ireland, and it would have made sense because he's had so many of them. But he was just like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to be able to have the creative freedom to have him drink like a beer, and just it be a beer, not be anything else. So, you know, I think books, the pressure is off a little bit in terms of that. But I do think you have a responsibility in terms of what you're saying to kids. And I think a lot of, I don't know, I think a lot of books I find are very much about hope. And when I write, definitely I want the reader to come away feeling hopeful about the future and empowered as well, that they can make a difference. Like, I mean, I think there's a lot of really strong female central characters that are out there now. And I hope that for a younger generation reading those, that they're going to like take that when they go and face obstacles in their own life.
You've kind of detailed some of the things that a YA novel does not need to be there, right? Because you don't have those pressures. But I speak to a lot of writers for adults that write crime, write thrillers, psych thriller, that kind of stuff. I guess just for someone who doesn't know how to write YA, what would you say that it does need to be? What are the differences that you do need to include if you're writing for a teenager that is maybe completely unique to if you were writing for a 30-year-old?
For me, and I think that's kind of like, that is a definition a lot of people have problems nailing down. But for me, it starts with the age of the main character. If your main character is a teenager, it's almost certain that you're going to be, you know, writing that book and for readers who are also teenagers, that they're going to be a little bit aspirational. Maybe if you have a character who's 15, probably 12 and 13 year olds are going to read it a lot more than 15 year olds, because they always read a little bit ahead of their actual age range. And for YA, there is a lot of YA that is in the first person, and it's that sense of immediacy in terms of the voice and in terms of moving the story forward. It's almost, you know, it moves at its own pace in terms of it's I think it's a faster moving in terms of pacing, age of the central character, and somewhat the kind of like the theme or the setting, because YA tends to be about, you know, that where you're still in school and your problems when you're in school are completely different to the problems you have as a new adult having graduated college and starting your first job, or the problems you have as like a parent or, you know, in their 30s or 40s, your worries and concerns are so much different then. Whereas in the teen cycle, friends are really, really important, and the friendships are really important and play probably a bigger part for teenagers than even the parental roles. But you still have that teen drama thing of like, you know, finding rebelling against your parents and them telling you to do one thing, or rebelling against authority in schools. And it puts a different structure, I think, even from the get-go, if you're writing for teens there. I really wanted to write something that was set in video games. Like, I'd spent about a year and a half doing research and producing a show that was on video games, and not just talking about like reviewing them, but really going and meeting coding people and developers and profiling, you know, people who were innovative in terms of the games that they were creating and where gaming is going. Like, I looked a good bit at a thing called CBI, which is computer brain interfaces, because I just was so stunned by it, that you could put something on your head and then not use a controller to move the avatar of the game, that you could just think it and it would move. I just found that fascinating. Like, you know, that you have like a game like Pong, where you're moving a ball back and forwards across the screen and hitting it back and forwards, and you're doing that purely by thought, as opposed to using a controller or your fingers or your hands or anything. And I started thinking, you know, if you have something like that, which is sending brain signals to a game and getting the game to play those out, what if you inverted it? What if the signals came from the game and went into your brain? So in essence, you no longer were playing the game. The game started to play you. And where does that go to? And that's how I think that started. In terms of the characters, It was really random, but I was at the school gates one morning and somebody told me this story about a friend of theirs who was selling a house, and she grew up in the care system in the UK, and she had what she considered to be a brother. They weren't in any way related, but they were two kids who were in the care system at the same time, and they became almost like they were each other's family. They stayed in touch all their way through life. They helped each other in terms of when they were in college, supported each other. They became each other's fan family, and acted completely like a brother and sister. And when he died, he left all the money that he didn't have any children. He hadn't married. He left all of his money and fortune to her. And after he died, his blood relatives came out of the woodwork and demanded a piece of the inheritance that she had received, because they said they were blood family. These people had known seemingly their entire lives where this kid was and had just never, ever wanted to get involved in his life until they knew there was money on the table. And I started, it's a horrible story, but it started me thinking about how for teenagers in growing up in care, there is that really strong bonding relationships. And I knew from hearing that story that I wanted the central character to be someone like that, someone who really went through the system and had nothing. You know, she wasn't going to be someone who would find a mysterious birthright later, and she wouldn't have magical superhero powers, and there wouldn't be any enchanted thing that she would have to save her. This girl would have to have her own skills that she was self-taught, in this case coding, and that she would use her own brain to get herself out of the situations that she found herself in. And that was really important to me, actually, in terms of, we spoke earlier about messages for people to take from the book. And that was a really big message for me, which was that, you know, one person, no matter what the obstacles, can make a difference.
You mentioned earlier that you are a plotter. I mean, it might change along the way, but you are someone who needs a thread.
A roadmap.
You need a roadmap, exactly. So when you've had that very initial idea about computer signals controlling you, what do you sit down? What do you do? What questions are you asking before you start writing the first sentence? How are you putting together this map?
I have this thing that I do almost to test the story before I start to write it. And it's one page. And I think it's a really well-known story aesthetic in terms of, like, you know, every story starts with a character who has a problem, and they have to have a problem because otherwise it's not a very interesting story. So it's always a character who has a problem, who initially resists solving that problem, who then has to go and solve that problem, who starts on a journey where they try to solve the problem, fail, try again, fail again. And then there's this all or nothing moment where they put everything into trying to solve this problem, and they will either win or they will either succeed or they will lose. And that is basically story structure. Like, it's a story structure you can apply to any story that is out there. So I start with the characters in the story world and the setting, and I go, what's their problem? And how are they going to get past this problem? What are the things that could be steps in terms of them solving the problem? What other characters need to be in this story to make this viable or not viable? And how many obstacles you can place in front of your character? Because I think that's something maybe we need to do more of, is actually, for me anyway, is obstacles. Because sometimes you fall so in love with a character, you want to give them a little bit of an easier life. And that's really an injustice to both the character and the reader. You need to put as many obstacles between them and their end goal as you possibly can. So if I do that and I can make a compelling or at least a readable first page, then I know I've got a story that I can actually, you know, write. If I'm falling apart by the time it comes to the second obstacle and thinking, ugh, this is just stretching out this drama, it doesn't really feel right, then it's not something I'll pursue. I'll just put it into the back of the notebook and leave it there until something else can be added or something else occurs to me, but I won't start writing it.
And I guess last question, because you've worked across so many different forms of stories, both producing and in writing, what have you learned organically rather than just, you know, being taught or whatever it is, organically about the best way to put a story together and to get yours done and to get it out there and to get it readable?
I think for me, the first thing is to take the pressure off yourself. I think we all need to remind ourselves the first draft does not need to be amazing and nobody else needs to see it if you don't want to share it with anybody else. So you really just can go crazy, you know, and I know of people who draft and put like brackets, insert more story here, close brackets, and then move on to the next point. You know, and that's fine too, but it's really just about getting the bones of a story on a piece of paper, because once you have the bones, you can start to add or subtract. I find for me, I also have this tendency to write my way into a story where I'm writing and almost certainly I know afterwards I'm going to end up cutting the first chapter, the first two chapters I've written because I had to write my way in. I find it's always better to start on the action or a point of action and really like kind of almost grab your reader and bring them with you as opposed to doing a two-page setup of, and then there's this thing and you need to do this thing. And also maybe you don't need to reveal everything to the reader at the start. Maybe it's more fun for them to discover things along the way. And there is another sequence as well, actually, in film. There's a tendency to write in terms of eight sequences. So you have your first sequence, which is your setup, and then it ends into your second sequence, which is your plot point, which is the introduction of the problem the character needs to overcome. And then you have three and four, which are kind of like a building, rising tension, getting you to the midpoint in the story. And sometimes, and then obviously six and seven are kind of like the resolution and falling action. And then eight is the final resolution of the character and story and it's the end. So sometimes when I'm plotting something, I will split it into eight sections so I can feel it's more manageable. So like my first two might be kind of like set up, the three and four might be what's happening up to the midway point in the book where you have that moment where everything changes and then you're going in a different direction. And I find that's helpful, actually, just to have it and break it down so that when you reach that point when you're writing where you kind of go, oh, God, where am I going with this? What does the character do next? You have something you can just kind of refer back to and go, they need to get to here. So you constantly know they need eventually to end up in this place. So it becomes easier to track the journey of how they get there. And that's why I plot. I think that for me, otherwise, I would be sitting there at like page probably 30,000 words in going, oh, God, where do they go next? I really need to know where they're going, just even vaguely. Like, I mean, sometimes they do other things along the way that I hadn't even thought of. And sometimes characters emerge that you really weren't in the original even outline, but they feel so strong and so right for the story, you end up putting them in.
And that is it with Triona Campbell. That new novel is The Traitor in the Game. It's out right now. You can get a copy online. Thank you so much to Triona for coming on the show and for making, well, certainly me, incredibly envious of being able to escape to Portugal for 18 months to write books. We'll be back with a brand new guest next week on the podcast. In the meantime, you can support us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Drop us a follow on X. We are at writerspod there. And get in touch using the contact page over at writersroutine.com. Thank you so much to our sponsor for this week, who is The Cheese Wire Killer, brand new true crime podcast. You are in the center of that live investigation. All the episodes are there for you to crack through right now. Search wherever you get your podcasts. And I will see you next week. Until then, bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.